Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast of Who's Here in the Hamptons. I'm Dan Rettiner, your host, broadcasting from my home in the Hamptons, where I have lived for over 55 years. I've written a dozen books about this glorious place, and I've seen it grow through the years from small tourist towns, quaint fishing villages, and a summer playground for high society, to what it is today, a world-class resort for celebrities, artists, musicians, authors, and billionaires. In my podcast, I will bring you interviews with not only these people, but also prominent local people who have helped shape the Hamptons. Welcome to Dan's Talks. My guest today is New York Times number one best-selling book author, Gail Forman. Gail has a new book out, and I wanted to talk to her about that. I read one of your books has been translated into 40 languages. Also, my question is, how many have you written besides those 40 language books?
I always sort of stumble on this question because written or published, I think that this is my, not nothing is my 13th published book.
Let me ask you about this. If it's your 13th and you don't look very old, so I would say you were pretty young when you thought of this, that you might start to write books. So I wanted to ask you about that. How did you come to think you might be able to want to do that?
Well, you flatter me, Dan. So thank you for that. I'm not that young. I actually had a whole career as a journalist before I started writing fiction. And I traveled around the world with my husband for a year in 2002 and wrote a sort of a nonfiction travel book about that. And then I came home and had a baby. And suddenly I couldn't travel for work. I didn't want to travel for work. So I wound up writing a young adult novel when she was just a baby. She just turned 20, so that should give you an idea of how long I've been doing this. And I would like write it while she was napping. She took long naps, so that's how I wrote the first book. So that was 20 years ago now. And so in those 20 years, I've written a little more than a book every other year.
Well, what went through your mind with the first one you wrote? What made you want to write it? What sort of thing was it about, and so forth?
Well, the first one is something called Sisters Insanity, and it's not one of my better known books. So that one, I think, came out of an idea I had when I was a journalist. But the truth was, my husband and I just bought our first apartment, and it had like a tax abatement that hadn't kicked in, and I couldn't travel, and I was like not making enough money. And I called my agent at the time. I'm like, do you have anything, any ghostwriting? Like, I can't pay our bills. And she's like, there's a young adult project that I have, but you should just like write your own. And that was on a Thursday. And I remember by the Monday, I had written like the first chunk of that book, like not knowing that I didn't really know what I was doing, but knowing enough from the years of journalism and the years of like spending time with young people. So I wrote that book. And then
what was it about?
That one is about young people, these girls at a behavior modification boot camp in Utah. And it's interesting because when I was at 17, I've been thinking about this a lot now with the book that I'm out with, about to come out, Not Nothing, is it was really kind of informed by what had happened with young people following Columbine, which we really paid attention to because we wrote for and about young people, which was like this, in an effort to protect them, they were kind of being criminalized. And you saw all of these like sort of barely licensed therapeutic, in air quotes, boot camps where young people went, and they were really terrible. They were not therapeutic and they were really damaging. So that had bothered me, this sort of criminalizations of adolescence. And so when my agent said that, it was like, wow, I could do that. And that's kind of where I learned the big lesson about fiction writing, which is, I'm stealing this from somebody else, but fiction is the lie that tells the truth. So by telling a fictional story, I think I can tell a more urgent truth than I can otherwise. And so the first book, the one that you mentioned that got translated into 40 languages, which people mistake as my first book because it's the first anybody paid attention to, but it's my third book. that one was, based on a very, very personal tragedy that had happened 7 years prior. And suddenly, through writing this sort of fictional story about this young woman named Mia, who's in a car accident and finds herself sort of out of body, trying to decide whether she should live or die or go with her parents and her family. That really sort of was born out of losing four friends of ours, a family, and always wondering if the little boy who had been medevaced out and died after the rest of his family chose to stay or not with his family. And so through this fictional story, I got to explore that. And I also got to kind of bring my friends back, because the family in that book is very much based on, you know, my friends who I had lost and, you know, the big, great tragedy and heartbreak of my life.
Where are you from originally?
I'm originally from California. I traveled for a couple of years after high school, lived in Amsterdam, and then moved to Oregon, and then moved from Oregon to New York, which is, you know, carry me out of here feet first.
Did you go to college?
I did go to college. I went to college when I was 21, and I went to the University of Oregon solely because it was the school that had like the latest application deadline. By the time I decided to go to school, it was too late to apply to the UC schools. So I kind of went up there. I thought I wanted to be a doctor and work for Doctors Without Borders. And after a year of pre-med, realized that was not for me. But wound up studying journalism, and University of Oregon has an amazing journalism program. And I met my husband there and a lot of my friends there. So lived in Oregon until I graduated. And then we packed up everything we had in a Ryder truck and moved east and haven't looked back.
Where did you go? Where have you been a journalist? What media?
Magazine journalism. Remember magazines?
Talk about the book you've just written, and we'll stick on that for a while.
Sure, I'm going to grab a copy. There.
Yeah, there you go.
This is not nothing. It is my 13th book. I'm not supposed to say this. Don't let the other books hear, but it's my favorite. It is ostensibly a middle grade novel, which means it's for readers, you know, 8 and up, but it's a multi-generational book. My shorthand for it is that it's The Princess Bride meets Schindler's List. And if that sounds odd, it's about a 12-year-old boy who has done something very bad. And we don't tell you what it is until sort of toward the end of the book. But because of this, he is awaiting a hearing at the end of the summer to determine what's going to happen to him. And his social worker arranges for him to volunteer at an assisted living facility called Shady Glen. And Alex, the boy, really does not want to be there. He's angry, he's resentful, and he's kind of freaked out by Shady Glen, but he doesn't have a choice. And making things worse, there's another 12-year-old volunteering there, this sort of very bossy girl named Maya Jade. So Alex inadvertently winds up in the room of Josie Kravitz, who's 107 years old. He's a Polish-Jewish Holocaust survivor. He is just kind of like waiting and waiting to die. He hasn't spoken in 5 years because what is there to say? But when Alex kind of bumbles into his room, Josie starts speaking to him, and he starts telling Alex the story of a young woman named Olga, who was somebody that Josie knew. Olga worked for his family's store in Krakow. And at first, when he met Olga, she was kind of bitter and resentful and maybe even bigoted and did something that could have gotten her fired. But instead, Josie, who recognized that he was like a privileged young man who was about to inherit a clothing store and didn't know how to sew, asked Olga to teach him to sew. And in doing so, changes the trajectory of all of their lives. Sewing saves his life many times. He falls in love with Olga, who also saves his life. So as he tells Alex the story in present day, right, Alex begins to kind of see parallels of his own life. And there's sort of a theme of the book where, you know, Olga was invited to rise to the occasion of her life by Josie. And once she got that invitation to sort of be her better self, she just rose and rose and rose and became a hero. And so Alex begins to wonder about that. Like, you know, what happens if he tries to rise to the occasion of his life? And it sort of changes him and it changes Josie.
That's quite a topic. I had that happen to me. When I was in high school, I got a very serious illness, and I realized after the surgery that was done that they had talked to me about maybe this, you know, you're not going to last much longer. So
wow.
So I thought about it, and I said, I got to do something that matters. I want to be helpful and somehow make people happy. And it changed my whole thinking about moving along in through life. But I gather in this case, it was a different thing. I guess the different kinds of things that would cause that to occur are different from one another. Maybe you can address that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you were wrong, because it appears that you had more than a couple years left. And I'm glad that sort of galvanized you into finding a life of sort of meaning. And I think, you know, Alex has had a really tough life, and he has, you know, every reason to feel resentful and angry and bitter. And yet that kind of bitterness, when you just sit in it, it tends to corrode you from within. And that's where he is when we see him. He's 12 and he has done something truly bad. Josie is the narrator of our story, this 107-year-old man. And he tells you right from the beginning that the boy did something very bad. He's not trying to sidestep it. He's not trying to, you know, it's not for him to forgive one way or another. But it really looks at what happens when you have a difficult life without a lot of support and not any offers or invitations to become your better self. And so for Alex, it's just this, it's a very foreign concept. And yet there's something in him that wants to do better, that wants to be better. And when he's at Shady Glen, he's sort of suddenly given these small moments. It starts small, like him feeling useful because he can deliver meals during a lockdown, or he can get somebody their stamps, or he can help somebody with a crossword puzzle. And it grows from there when he begins to really sort of see that even at 12, there's things that he can do. And I like to think that it will change the trajectory of his life too. But you do eventually learn about the bad thing that Alex did, and it is terrible. And it's this idea of do we judge people, especially young people, by the worst things that they've done, or do we give them the grace to grow and learn from their mistakes and pave the way for them maybe to do some better things and even some best things? And by hearing about Olga, who very much could have gone one way and went another way, it's a pivotal moment for Alex. And, you know, I think a pivotal moment for all of us right now to sort of decide, like, how do we want to be? Who do we want to be? How does being connected to other people and being part of something sort of larger than ourselves make us feel in a way that, like, other things maybe that are more sort of egocentric don't?
Tell me about the book. And this book is just now, as I understand it, within a week or two or just past.
It hasn't even come out. It comes out on Tuesday. And my first event that I'm doing is out in the Hamptons on Thursday.
Oh, why is this your first one? It happened.
It was a friend of mine who I was saying, you know, the book is coming out while everybody's in New York is on vacation. I don't want to do an event in the middle of the city, August 27th. If you're a New Yorker, you know, no one is here. And she said, I have a great idea. And she introduced me to her friends and who are avid readers and sort of part of a Jewish community out there. And sort of they got it cooking. And now I'm doing the launch event at the Hampton Library in Bridgehampton.
Oh, that's great. And tell me about what happened after the book came out, the one that was the most popular one.
If I stay.
And so, including that they made it into a movie.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, when I first wrote my first YA novel, it was because we were broke and couldn't sort of make ends meet. And when I wrote If I Stay, things were not much different. But what was different was that my now 20-year-old daughter, I'd been basically home with her for the first 3 years. Like, we'd had babysitters here and there, and I'd written books during her naps and some magazine articles. But she went off to school, and suddenly I had like 5 hours a day free. And it's strange because my friends had died. It was a mom and a dad and two boys, and these were my godsons. They had died in 2001, so this was years before. But suddenly that question that I had about the boy who was medevaced out, did he choose to go with his family? Like, all of a sudden I woke up one morning and there was this young woman. She was 17 years old. She was dark haired and dark eyed and very serious. And she was a cellist. This was news to me. I have no background in cello or classical music. And I knew she was going to answer that question. I sat down and I started to write. And I had no agent at the time. The editor I'd worked with had left. And I remember just thinking, because it kind of was back and forth between this one day in Mia's life and these flashbacks, I didn't think it was a viable book. So when I saved it on my hard drive, I saved it as why not? As in, like, this is never going to go anywhere, but why not? And I wrote that book. It was the fastest book I've ever written. I wrote it in 3 months, and the final version, not that different than the version that came out. And then when it started to go out into the world, first like to publishers and then to people, it was this surreal experience because it was this thing I had written sort of in this little vacuum and bringing my friends back and sort of sobbing in my living room corner. And then all of a sudden it was just going out to people of all ages, of all nationalities, and having this impact. And I think that was my, aside from it being like just kind of surreal, like this, it felt like this really amazing thing that was happening to somebody I liked a lot, but that wasn't me. Aside from all that, it was just this real lesson of just like how much words can connect you to other people. It was this deeply personal experience, and it was touching people who I never met and never would meet in a deeply personal way. And that was pretty profound. Aside from like the eventual 40 languages and the movie that they made of it, like just that was just my first experience of just what the power of books.
Were you involved with the making of the movie at all?
I was a producer on it, and I sort of worked a bit on the script and was close with the producer and the director. I didn't sort of write it or anything like that, but I got my sort of first taste of sort of how the sausage is made.
When was that, when did that movie come out?
I think it's like almost 10 years to the day. I think it came out like August 20 something.
Anybody in it, any we would know?
Well, Chloe Moretz is the young woman who played Mia, and so she's sort of the most well known. And Stacy Keach played the grandma, the grandfather, and he had the most tear-jerky scene of the entire thing. And I don't think people like can't even look at Stacy Keach anymore without being like, ugh.
Was it a big hit or middle line or a flop?
No, it was a big hit. It was a 10 million budget movie that went on to make like $80 million. So, back in the day, when I look at what box office does now, I mean, it would have been a monster hit now because we haven't really come back to seeing movies the way we did. But yeah, that was the year of the weepy movies. We had The Fault in Our Stars earlier that year, and then If I Stay later that year, and we kept audiences awash in tears.
Tell me about you. What you said you've come out and been out here visiting people from time to time. So what's it? And
Yes.
either way, with your glasses, good with them on, good with them
Yeah,
off.
no, I think there was a little notice. I only need them if I have to read something. So, I have a really good friend who lives in Sag Harbor, and for about the last 7 or 8 years, we have been doing wintertime writing retreats at what had been her little bungalow. She has since transformed her little bungalow into like a nicer pad. But we would just go out in February when it was just completely dead, and we would sort of sit out there, and we would write our. I would. She's a scientist, and so she was always writing papers and grants and like explaining things about like R1 and that whole world. And I would sort of work on these books. And it's interesting because it was a period of time where I was like casting about writing a bunch of books that at the time I didn't like, but since have realized that sometimes you need to put a book away on the hard drive and it comes back. So not nothing was written there. And then I have friends, a really good friend of mine, who I see a lot, that she bought a place in Montauk recently. And I'd never actually, in all my time going out, and made that jump all the way out to Montauk, and I loved it. I have other friends who have a place in Springs. So, and my daughter was friends with their kids and likes to surf. So, that's been my sort of experience. I love the beach, and I grew up in California, but when my kids were little, I found it so exhausting to have to keep an eye on them at the beach that we actually started going upstate and became sort of lake people. So that's where our upstate world is, the divide between lake people and the beach people.
Where were you in California, San Francisco?
No, I was in LA. So I grew up going to Malibu Beach. There was like a beach bus that you used to be able to take, and it would take you right to the beach. And back in the days where we would slather ourselves with baby oil and just sit at the beach all day, get munched by those waves. Water was always cold. So when I started going to the beach here, I was like, I couldn't believe how warm the water was, particularly this time of year. It's just pretty magical.
Yeah. Well, the whole area out here is amazing.
Yeah. It's beautiful, and the farm stands and the food, and I love it. I think it's gorgeous.
What does, are you a cook as well?
Am I a cook as well? Yes, I'm a big cook.
Well, it's good to talk to you, and I want to wish you the best, and thank you for being on the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
Enjoyed it, and I'll come to your reading, and we'll go from there.
Oh, I would love that. That'd be amazing.
Okay, thank you. Bye
Thank
bye.
you, Dan.